When Buddhism went from India to China, they translated all the Sanskrit words into Chinese words, and the two main forms of Buddhist meditation practice in Sanskrit are called, or in Pali at least, it's almost the same, is called Samatha and Vipassana. And Samatha is usually understood to be kind of concentration practice. And Vipassana is the practice of mindfulness, of insight, and what we practice here. So they had to find Chinese equivalents of Samatha Vipassana, and they had no clear words that were comparable. So they came up with the words stop for concentration and look for Vipassana. So it's very nice, stop and look. That's what they translate, you know, these two words, stop and look. And, you know, it kind of makes it a lot simpler. And in a sense, that's a big part of what we're practicing is stopping to look, stop and look. And half of what we do, in a sense, is learning how to stop. Stop the incessant busyness of the mind, or stop the racing ahead of our thoughts, our feelings, our ideas. Stop the kind of all the ways in which we get lost in our feelings or lost in our self-preoccupations, or being self-conscious. And then take a clear stop enough so you can see clearly what's going on. And the mindfulness is the practice of just seeing clearly. In looking clearly at what's going on, the way it's described, you know, stop and to look, it has a kind of passive side to it. You stop, which is you become kind of passive, you're not acting anymore, and then you simply look around, or you watch, or you notice, you look. And which looking can have a kind of a passive feel. Often we talk about just allowing all things to be as they are and just notice how they are. And sometimes people who practice Vipassana, mindfulness practice, tend to get the strong message that there's a kind of passive quality, receptive quality to the practice. And as a Buddhist, a form of Buddhism, that's only half the picture. And the other half of the picture is it's developing active qualities and developing strength, inner strengths that we carry with us, not just simply a capacity to be open or a capacity to be present and receptive. Some years ago, I was listening to the radio, and there was a woman talking about, she was a back expert, and she was talking about how in the recent time, she said, there was a kind of general trend away from a tendency that had been in the 20s and 30s or something, or earlier. The earlier tendency had been, if you have some kind of physical problem, you had to strengthen yourself. And people would go out and they'd strengthen themselves somehow. And now the bias is in the direction of, you've got to just relax. You've got to release. You've got to go lay on a bed and just kind of let the body heal itself and not try to do anything. And sometimes, from her point of view, that was overdone in our modern society. And sometimes what people needed to do was to bring strength, to strengthen themselves in order to have some kind of healing. And I know a friend of mine who had carpal tunnel disease tried all kinds of various strategies for dealing with it. For the most part, they were all kind of passive, you know, wrist guards and then acupuncture and kind of physical therapy of various types, until a physical therapist told her that she had to start lifting weights. And for her particular form of what she had, lifting weights and building up strength in her shoulders was what it took to help her with her particular problems. So the idea of building up strength, so the active side of meditation practice. And the active side that I want to talk about today, and one of the things we stop and look at and pay attention to, is a side of intentions, our motivations for what we do. Buddhism is understood, can be understood as being a religion of motivation, focusing on motivation. That intention has a really preeminent role in our inner life from the point of view of Buddhism. And attending to our intention, noticing what motivates us, what our aspirations are, learning how to have strength of intention, get behind our intentions and act on them, noticing the consequences of the various intentions we act on, is a really key element of Buddhist spirituality. So I want to talk a little bit today about intention, about looking at it, attending to it, and being wise about our motivations. And part of my motivation to give this talk is that I've noticed among some people, a few people, a small minority perhaps, of people in the spiritual circles, in Buddhist circles, who approach meditation with a kind of magical thinking, where they think that if they just put their butt on the cushion and sit there long enough and kind of do their duty spiritually, something's going to happen. And often just simply stopping, it is pretty transformative for some people who are always busy. But some people kind of expecting something to happen to them. The grace of God, the grace of the Buddha, or something's going to come and just kind of do something, and they're going to be, you know, transformed and enlightened and happily ever after. And I know one person who spent years going on retreats, and 10-day retreats, longer retreats, and had that attitude and was getting bitterly disappointed in the practice because nothing was happening to her. There was no change. Because she thought if she was just diligent and dedicated and put in her time, the rest would happen on its own. There has to be an element of taking responsibility for ourselves and our choices, our mental states, that goes along with meditation practice. And if we're not taking some responsibility in the practice, then we're missing out on a big potential of what the practice has to offer. If we just keep it in the passive kind of mode, it can be a little bit myopic. So intention, to look at our intentions. Intentions have a big consequence on our inner life. And the very loaded for a lot of Westerners, Buddhist word connected to intention is karma. And you find people talking very glibly or lightly about karma sometimes these days in the West. It's your karma to do that, and you know, it's that happened to you because of your karma, or you got sick, it must be your karma, and then you discounted. The word karma has kind of entered the kind of dictionary, I imagine, in the West, or at least in common usage. And in the Buddhist use of the word karma, the Buddha clearly equated karma with intention. And because your karma is your intention, is the intentional activities you do affects your karma, creates your karma. So how does that work? Karma is kind of a vague word. People react against it a little bit negatively because it can have a whole large kind of association of almost superstition. Kind of this big kind of accountant up in the sky someplace who's measuring out your activities and measuring your karma and weighing it out and then dispensing justice or boons depending on what how it all the equations work themselves out. I think it's helpful to look at it this way. If you have two people working in the same, they're partners and they're going to start a business together. And so they both have basically the same intention on the surface, kind of physically, to start this business. However, the underlying motivation for why they want to start a business can be quite different between these two people. One of them wants to get rich as quickly as possible. And, within 5 years, he or she wants to retire a millionaire, or at the minimum, at least. That's kind of poor if you're just a millionaire in some eyes. So, really kind of do well. And it's going to do whatever he or she can to attain that. The other person, the other partner, what's important is not making a lot of money quickly, but rather is to create a company where there's a wonderful sense of morale among the workers, where the well-being, a kind of sense of community among the people who work there, and a sense that people are taking care of each other and helping people working there to bring out the best in them. So it's a very fulfilling personal place for people to work. And that really the reason that person went into business in the beginning was to kind of create this kind of nurturing, supportive environment for people. And so both those two people are engaged in this business together, side by side, making many of the same decisions. However, the background of the decisions is that they have a little bit different motivations of why they're making their decisions. Maybe over and over again making exactly the same practical decision, but in the background there's a different wish of what they want to accomplish. Well, after 4 years, it goes bust. And 4 years is a long time in the dot-com world, right? It's like forever. It's a successful business. So I should say maybe after 6 months they get bust or whatever. what's the consequence? What's left over? What happens to these two partners? The person who just wanted to make a lot of money maybe just feels bitterly disappointed. You know, I wasted this good parts of my life, threw myself into it, and wasted my time, my money, and I have nothing to show for it, and probably I should blame my partner because he, you know, whatever, and he was this touchy-feeling kind of guy, and whatever. And so, the other partner might feel, well, that was too bad that business failed, but in those 4 years that we worked there, we had a really good company, really good morale among everyone. Everyone was really grateful to work there, and we really nurtured a lot of people to come forward and develop themselves. And those people who worked for us, a lot of them now are able to move on, get to work jobs elsewhere because they were so well trained and taken care of here. And that person feels, well, it was kind of a pity that job ended, but it's really nice that I have this. I did this once in my life that I really tried to make this work. And I feel, and that person leaves a certain level of joy and delight and self-satisfaction for having done some kind of basically an act of service. Because of their different motivations starting off, they leave the situation with a very different inner sense. And that inner sense is what we're talking about in karma. What's that inner life like? What's the inner ecology like? How is it shaped by the motivations that drive us, that inform our decisions, the one we make? I was many years ago, 8 years ago or so, I was invited over to Pleasanton. Is that where the women's prison is? Federal prison? Federal penitentiary for women. Fullerton? Pleasanton? Fullerton? Over well, the other side of the bay somewhere. Fullerton? There's a men's prison next door. Doesn't do them any good. It's like when I went to boarding school in Switzerland. I chose it because it was co-ed. And there was, you know, the women were a mile away, and there was this fence with this wall with glass on the top, and these German shepherds in the yard. And, you know, I didn't even know that women existed, you know, in this co-ed school. But anyway, so I went over to see the women, and I was going to do a day-long meditation retreat for them. And there were, I think, maybe 20 or 30 or 40 women who showed up for the retreat. And some of them were there just to, I don't know, hang out, be tourists, kind of look at a guy for a while or something. they just kind of, you know, slouched against the wall listening. But there were a couple of women who really impressed me. And remember one woman in particular who kind of sat kind of almost directly in front of me. And she sat up really the dignified way, and she had these bright, you know, alive, happy eyes, and real intense. She went into meditation very intently, and she had this kind of yogic body. So she, in the course of the day, she told me that she had, when she entered prison, she had decided that she was going to make the prison her monastery, and she was going to dedicate herself to a spiritual life and do yoga and meditation. And the 3 or 4 years she'd been there, she was, you know, she was radiating a kind of presence and a peace and joy that very few people who are outside of prison have. And it was very interesting to see, you know, she had made a choice about an intentional choice of how she was going to live her life in the prison, a very demanding situation that other women in the same room had not made for themselves. And you could really feel the difference between the consequences of that over the number of years. So the intentions, the choice, the intentions behind what we do shape the inner landscape. They have a consequence in our lives that are different than the external causal consequences that we often focus on or notice. So these two business partners, they started a business. The choice was to start a business. The choice was to make these decisions in the business, and then it failed. And that's what we see on the surface. And if you look at the surface, so that they were failures, they were dot-com failures, and you know whatever, and maybe feel sorry for them or angry with them or, you know, whatever we feel, you know, they failed at their business. But if you look kind of underneath the surface at what's going on in the inner landscape, then there's a very different evaluation that we see. And we see this radical difference between these two partners. And in the inner landscape, the motivations that they were acting, basing their life on, had a big difference in their well-being. The person whose decisions led to a sense of satisfaction, even though the business failed, is better set up in the future to have their to be guided by decisions which bring joy and delight. There's kind of these things are kind of self-reinforcing. The person who was set himself up or herself up to be disappointed and angry and bitter is, in a sense, setting themselves up for not appreciating, not respecting the power of their intention and power that what difference their inner life can make. It can be very small to notice what our decisions are and what the consequences are as a result of those decisions. Where is it we take our inspiration from, our sustenance from? One of the things that's somewhat strange for Westerners when they hear about Buddhist teachings is the Buddhist teaching of rejoicing in your good qualities. Inevitably, someone will think, that seems pretty selfish, you know, to go around focusing on your good qualities and celebrating them. But in Buddhism, it's considered very efficacious to spend some time reflecting on your good deeds and good qualities, the good things you've done in your past, the good intentions you've acted on, and then enjoy them, appreciate them, feel happiness for them, for that. And it's not meant to be a egotistical thing at all. Buddhism is the religion that says, which focuses on what's not self. It kind of pulls the rug from underneath egotism. But pulling the rug away from being egotistical doesn't mean you can't also then at the same time appreciate those good qualities which happen to be there. You can do it in a non-egotistical way. One of the good qualities, one of the sources of appreciation of oneself is appreciation of the intentions by which we live our lives. What are the underlying motivations which motivate us? And the advantage of focusing on that, rather than the worldly success and failures, is that you can still fail and appreciate your intentions. Not only that, but because you are acting on your intentions, trying to act on them, you're strengthening some inner part of who you are. You're strengthening your intentions. You're strengthening various kind of the capacity to act on those intentions, like strengthening a muscle. And so even if you fail in the activity you wanted to do, the inner life, the inner landscape, which has nothing to do with worldly success and failure, has been developed and strengthened. Buddhist practice doesn't care that much about how successful you are in your worldly life. It's nice if you can do good things for the world and be successful at it. And Buddhism is not supposed to stand in the way of that. But Buddhism itself is not so overly interested in that. So when you fail, you know Buddhism is there to accept you. But rather, Buddhism focuses on what that inner landscape is like and what that inner landscape is you're shaping. If the first businessman who wanted just to make a lot of money had succeeded in his business and made a lot of money, he might have had a certain kind of happiness from not having being wealthy. But chances are that the inner landscape was not improved one bit because motivations of greed only got stronger and reinforced because they had been successful. How are we shaping that inner landscape? What do we look at? What do we base our life on? One of the interesting exercises is to imagine that the anthropologist from Mars comes to look at your life. And the anthropologist from Mars can't look and see what goes on inside of you, you know, what's really what's driving you. And so it has to kind of make a really good guess. What is it that drives this person? What's really the operating motivation in this person's life? So the person sees, you know, that you come home from work and you flop in front of the couch and turn on soap operas and watch for 4 hours before you eat frozen dinner or whatever. And I said, well, you know, that person really seems to have a great motivation for television. It's really inspired and brings this person a lot of, you know, an inordinate amount of time watching it. It must be, you know, great, you know, great benefits of bringing this person. Or they notice how often there is a self-congratulatory statement. You know, the person, how often you say something to a friend, you know, about yourself. You make some statement about yourself that just basically a way of building up yourself in other people's eyes. Or the anthropologist might notice how often you rush. This person goes to church every Sunday. You know, it seems like, but that doesn't seem very important for that person because that's only like an hour of the week. Or they come here Thursday night or something. It's only an hour and a half of the week, and it doesn't seem very important. You know, activity overall. What the person spends is about at least 60 hours a week rushing. I think this is a religion of rushers. It's a rushing religion. And they have these special kind of altars, you know, and where they, you know, that helps them with their rushing. So what would you think someone would say about you if they saw you from the outside? What actually is the motivation that runs your life? And that's sometimes an interesting exercise because sometimes there can be a disjunction between the intention we want to live our life by and actually how we live our lives. And that disjunction is often, for some people, a source of pain, of suffering. Because they want to live some way, they want to live a better way. But they see they're not doing that. They want to be generous, but they're always being greedy. They don't always want to butt into people when they're speaking, but they want to kind of be better listeners, and they can't seem to do it. So in Buddhism, the focus is to stop and to look and to notice what is actually operating, what are the motivations and intentions, what are the choices that actually are operating in your life as you are right now. And to look at that without any particular judgment of it being good and bad, but to look at it because that's a starting point of understanding where we're at. What is the motivations that run our life? You know, both in terms of daily activities and also in terms of the bigger picture of why do you have the job that you have, those of you who work? Is it what motivates you to have that job? Is it because it's just a good way to make a living, make certain finite money? Is it because it makes a difference in the world in a positive way? Is it because it brings fulfillment in the activity you do? Is it because your parents expected you to work? Is it because you're afraid of taking risk in your life? If you weren't afraid of taking risk, you would have long since left that job and done something more interesting. So to look at these things, and then in that looking, spend some time evaluating what is your deepest intention? What is your deepest motivation? What's your heart's deepest wish? I think it's very easy for people to live a busy life. It's very easy to live a scared life where people are unwilling to look very deeply at what their deepest wish might be. And a busy life just kind of numbs out after a while. The demands of our life are, you know, we're all kind of running around a lot. We don't spend much time asking ourselves or checking in with ourselves, what is my deepest wish? When I used to live in monasteries, there were people who'd come periodically for a week or a month or 6 months or a year sometimes. And their motivation for coming to a Buddhist monastery was they wanted to find out what they were going to do with their life. They didn't have a deep motivation, a deep purpose of living. And they wanted to somehow clear the board, get away from all the normal activities and normal associations and normal relationships, and in the quiet of the retreat center, try to discover for themselves what is it they really wanted in life, what was their deepest motivation and wish for themselves. I think it's a very powerful exercise to every day spend a little bit of time thinking about what is your deepest wish for the day, what is your deepest aspiration, or for the day or for your life. I did this exercise in the following matter for about a year. But every day I would get up in the morning and I would think, if I knew that I had 24 hours left to live, how would I spend these next 24 hours? And that clarified a lot what was important for me. Because, you know, death is one of the great clarifiers of our values. And so much stuff, you know, can seem as being petty or unimportant or not of much value in the face that, you know, in 24 hours you're going to die. I did for a while. I did 3 or 4 death and dying workshops from a Buddhist point of view, and I did this exercise where you have people meditating, and then you'd ask them in the course of meditation, imagine that you've been told that you have, you know, a month left to live. What would you do? What would that be like? And then after a while you say, okay, now take a deep breath and clear your mind. And now imagine you had a week left. And after a while, a day left. And then an hour left. And then 5 minutes. And a minute. And then what if death was going to be now? So anyway, so I did that. And one woman afterwards reported what her experience was like. She was at this retreat center. We were doing it. And she said, oh, when we had 24 hours left, I rushed home so I could clean my apartment. But when I only had an hour left, there wasn't enough time to get home. So I relaxed and let go, and boy, I never knew I could let go so fully and so be so present. And suddenly I was present for the trees and the sound of the birds and the river nearby in a way that I didn't know was possible. And because I couldn't do all those things that I thought I had to do to kind of be successful or, you know, be a good girl or whatever. So sometimes, you know, thinking about death is a helpful way of thinking about what is your deepest intention for your life? What do you really most want? And then there's a whole process, if you do it regularly, that it tends to clarify and explore and massage that issue of intention. The deepest intention you might find when you start this exercise might not be very deep. And don't worry about that. Just what's the deepest one accessible to you? Don't judge it. And just hang out with that and live with that and maybe follow through on it. And then slowly, in the process of working with it and practicing, there's a clarification and purification of intention. Many years ago, I had been practicing as a Zen student for many years. And then I went and did Vipassana practice for a number of years in Southeast Asia. And one of the differences between Vipassana and Zen is in Vipassana, there's a lot of understanding about the inner world of meditation and the techniques of meditation and the mind states of meditation. And there's a lot of discussion between a teacher and a student about what those going on with those things. And in Zen, there was next to none of that, at least in my Zen center where I was at. And there often be very lengthy discussions between student and teachers, but we talk about worldly things, you know, relationships and jobs and, you know, understandings and philosophy and stuff. But meditation was almost never talked about. It was almost as if it was taboo to talk about your meditation, even though we spend a lot of time in meditation. And so I came back from Southeast Asia, and I was at a meeting of a group of teachers from the Zen Center. And I pointed this out. And I, you know, why is it we don't talk about meditation with our students? And no one said anything, which was kind of in character. And so, you know, I just, okay. So, but then after the meeting, one of the senior teachers came up to me and said, oh, by the way, I wanted to respond to you. And the reason we don't talk about meditation is that we approach the same thing from a different angle. And that is, what we focus on is intention. And we talk about, in student-teacher relations, we spend a lot of time talking about what people's intentions are and how well they understand their intentions for their life, for the activities they're doing, whatever they're doing, and clarifying their intention. And with the clarification and purification of intention, the process of meditation follows on its own, was a claim. That part of the process of Buddhist spirituality is a process of purifying our intention, clarifying what our intention is. So now I'm beginning to think maybe I'm rambling. Should I continue? Or should I ramble this way? Is this okay? So the issue of intention. A lot of people are very concerned about judgments of good and bad. Am I good enough? Am I doing it bad or whatever? And in Buddhism tends not to judge things according to the categories of good and bad. It tends to focus more on whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. The technical word is skillful and unskillful. So rather than good and bad, is it skillful to do that? Rather than say, that was a bad thing you did, you say, oh, that was an unskillful thing you did. Dear, that was an unskillful thing you did. And the way you say it, it might feel that you're saying it's bad, but be careful how you say it, what your intention is. But skillful and unskillful, is it skillful, is it helpful for the process of bringing you greater peace, freedom from suffering, greater compassion, greater presence? Is it helpful? Is it conducive towards your own well-being? Or is it conducive in the other direction? Is it move you in the direction of not being happy? So, for example, something like, you know, when I used to live in San Francisco and come down here, it was a little bit faster for me to drive down on 101 than 280. But what was most conducive to my well-being? I found out very quickly that it was more conducive for me to come down on 280. And I would arrive in a little bit better state of mind than I would coming down 101, even though it was took a bit longer. So it was more skillful to go down 280. So one of the criteria for what is skillful, though, is what is the intention behind the action? Because intention is what sets up the inner landscape, the inner ecology. And so when people ask, is that a good thing to do? Is that a bad thing to do? Was that a right thing to do? Or wrong? Is it a right thing to do? The Buddhist response is, well, let's look at the intention. What was your intention for doing this? Because you can do overtly in the external world something that looks good, something helpful for people. But the motivation inside might not be, for your inner landscape, might not be very conducive to your own inner well-being. So, for example, it's possible to go and help a neighbor out with they need some help, they're sick, and so you do their shopping for them. And it looks like, you know, that you're doing a great thing. But really what it is you want to be elected to be the local mayor. And so, you really want to be mayor, you think it'd be a great status to be the local mayor, and everybody's going to like you, and if you become mayor, then you can become local congressperson, and if you become congressperson, then you become senator, and eventually become president. You know, it'd be really great to be president of this country, but you need to get people's support behind you first, and you're really driven to become president of the United States. So you need to start small. So you go and help your neighbor with her grocery shopping, you know, and you really, you know, you couldn't even care less about your neighbor really, but it looks good. And of course, you can go help your neighbor because you're really concerned about your neighbor and you want to help, and you're not concerned at all about yourself, what it's going to do for yourself. So, from a Buddhist point of view, we're not interested as much in the external world of what's obvious meets the eye, as we are, what's the intention behind what you're doing? Are you trying to build up your sense of self? Are you trying to present yourself in a way that's somewhat egotistical? Are you trying to manipulate someone for your own good, for your own benefit? Are you trying to run away from situations? Are you being motivated by aversion or by fear? To act on aversion, to act on fear, strengthens, you're acting on an intention. The motivation then is a motivation of aversion, of pulling back, of running away. When you act on that, you strengthen that muscle. And you shape the inner landscape in a certain way. One of the ways in Buddhism we talk about it is we shape our dispositions. Sometimes it's called the habit formations inside of us. How we're disposed to act in the future is shaped in part by how we act today. And we need to take care of how we act today, the intentions we follow through on, to create a better disposition for the future so we can act better in the future. One of the ways of understanding karmic consequences is that is nothing more mysterious than you're creating a certain disposition, so you tend to act a certain way in the future. This is another story I thought of telling. I've told before on this topic. Some years ago, I was coming off the freeway 280 at Page Mill Road. I was going south on 280 and got off at Page Mill Road. And if you know that exit, there's a stop sign there. And the traffic goes, the cross track of traffic also has stop signs. So it's very, usually it's very polite and everybody stops and find your way. And I was in a hurry. I was coming in a hurry to come here and teach people to relax and slow down. And I was a little bit, not a lot in a hurry, but I was kind of a little pushing it more than I probably should have. And I came to the stop sign and I stopped. And then I continued. Because there was a car coming, but the car coming had a stop sign. So I knew that the car would stop. And so I had right of way. So I was going to go and do what I had my legal right to do, which was to go in. Well, the person didn't stop for the stop sign. And luckily, I kind of had enough wits about me that I put my brakes on and we missed each other. The person came right in front of me and missed by an inch or something. And I reflected on that. And it would have been very easy for me to have gotten angry at that person. If we had had an accident, legally, I think that person is responsible for the accident. From a legal point of view, that person caused the accident. They missed their stop sign. And I, from a normal kind of, from a common approach to living life, I would have had a right to be angry at that person. How could you be so dumb to have missed the stop sign and all that? The Buddhist analysis of the same situation is a little bit different. It's not denying where that kind of worldly responsibility and denying what the insurance companies would do about it. But the Buddhist point of view is to look, what was going on in your inner landscape? And I had to admit that I was rushing a little bit. And that if I hadn't been rushing a little bit, I would have been more attentive to what was going on with me. And I would have noticed that person was going to miss a stop sign a lot earlier than I did. The fact that I had this intention, this motivation to get someplace quickly was shaping the future outcome of what was going to happen. It wasn't going to be a necessary cause and effect relationship, but I was tending towards something that might happen. If that accident had happened, from a Buddhist point of view, or from the karmic point of view, I'm responsible for the karmic consequences of that. Which the insurance company is not going to help pay for anyway, but the inner karmic consequences, I have to take responsibility for. So the Buddhist analysis is often to look back at our intentions. What's motivating us? What's driving us? What are the choices we're making? And can we make wiser choices? Choices that are for the betterment of ourselves and for society around us. This is a really key part of Buddhist practice. And part of one of the things we do in mindfulness practice, one of the functions of mindfulness practice, is to help us in that study, in that investigation, to teach us the skills of stopping, slowing the mind down enough so we can see clearly, so we start becoming familiar with the inner landscape, so we can notice the subtlety of motivation, so we can learn the skills of noticing the inner landscape in an accepting, patient, and friendly way, compassionate way. Because so we don't meet the inner landscape with further condemnation or upset or whatever. So we're learning these skills in mindfulness to be receptive and accepting of what we see and to study and investigate. But at some point in practice, you want to use your mindfulness practice not just simply to get calm and then hope that the calm is going to take care of your life. If I get calm enough in meditation, then I can go back out into my life and just carry that with me everywhere and waft calmness everywhere I go and everybody will fall in love with me and everything will happen beautifully and there'll be no lines in Safeway. But rather, you use that calm to help study what is it that motivates me? What is it that are the choices I'm making in the inner landscape as I go along? And then the last thing I'll say in this line is one of the very practical ways you can do this study is do your daily meditation practice. And then as you leave your meditation practice, continue with the mindfulness. Some people's tendency is when they finish their meditation is they've done that, let's go. And they jump up and they grab their coffee and the newspaper and turn on the radio and get in the car and get the cell phone on at the same time and off they go. But rather, get up, leave your meditation, start your life. Start the day, but do a little bit slower than you normally would. Try to stay attentive for the first 5 or 10 minutes as you get up, for whatever long. Notice the first time as you leave meditation that you in some way get contracted or some way started rushing ahead of yourself. So you want to be mindful enough to catch the first moment. When you catch that first moment, then stop and look at what is it, what was it that motivated you to get contracted or to rush? What was the motivation? What was the choice at that moment? What was the values that you had bought into? And then look at that and say, do you really want to? Is this really what you want to live your, base your life on? Is it worth it? Is it really worth getting contracted like this over this particular thing? Maybe it is, you'll decide, but at least you know more clearly. Or maybe you'll see it's not worth it, and maybe there's another way of living. So, I didn't mean to talk so much. That wasn't my intention. So, comments, questions?
Sometimes when I go on retreat, I'll just have the thought that, you know, wow, I'm this real answer, negative comments that other people might have about, you know, what I feel I need to do.
Beautiful, that's very nice. It's very nice to be happy and to appreciate that. It's really a fantastic thing to do any spiritual practice at all. And it is a kind of sign of treating yourself really well. Traditionally in Buddhism, it's considered an act of self-respect. Having self-respect is considered very important. And one way to get self-respect if you don't have it is to make practical steps that do it, that there are signs of that or act on that. So doing a simple thing as, you know, sitting every day and you might have to feel self-respect when you start, but the fact that you can keep it up consistently over time is a proof that there is self-respect there and it strengthens it, and then the joy. And yes?
We practice when we're sitting here focusing on the breath. Is there another practice that you sit and then you meditate on? Not on the breath, but on what your intention is. I mean, as a sitting practice.
Definitely. You can spend some time, maybe at the end of your meditation in the morning, if you sit at home, spend the last 5 minutes thinking about your intentions for the day or for your life or for the moment. The way it works with Vipassana practice is that Vipassana practice itself, in and of itself, as a subcategory of other Buddhist practices, is a receptive mode of practice, where choiceless practice, where we just notice what's happening in the moment as clearly as we can. And we don't just focus on the breath when we do Vipassana. It's very powerful to do that, to stay with the breath. But we pay attention to whatever's predominant in the moment. So it might be the breath, or it might be feelings, might be body sensations, might be mental states or thoughts. One part of that, things that we can pay attention to that's occurring in the present moment, is our intentions. So as we're doing, as the mindfulness practice opens up beyond the breath to be choicelessly aware of whatever's going on in our experience, one of those things that is always operating is intention. Buddhist psychology teaches that intention is operating in every mind moment. It's always there. Buddhist psychology teaches that intention is operating in every mind moment. It's basically every, you know, it's always there. So as we open up to whatever's happening in the present moment, one of the things we become aware of is our intention. So for example, you're sitting here trying mostly to stay with your breath. Your mind wanders away. What is the intention that brings your mind back to the breath? And to study that, for example, because for some people, the intention is informed by disappointment, aversion, let's get away from that, by greed, by self-condemnation, by striving, because people will jerk their mind back to the breath, or pounce back on the breath, or go back to the breath and go, I got to get concentrated, or, I need to prove myself, I'm going to be a successful meditator. And there's all these kind of little subtle sub-agendas going on, even with such a simple thing as bringing the attention back to the breath. It could also be noble intentions. Oh, what I'm trying to do with being with my breath is to really try to be present and relaxed and awake to life as it is, so I can be compassionate and present for my whole life. So that motivation is there as you come back to the breath. I mean, it's there, it might be there anyway, but it can be noticed. I know for me sometimes that the intention to come back to my breath might sometimes is the intention of aversion is present as part of that process. And sometimes it's the motivation of love that's part of it. So intentions are operating, you know, all the time. Also, looking at our intentions, this is a little different topic. For a while I had a practice of having a date book, kind of schedule book, or write down, you know, things I had to do for the day. And then I would sit down in the morning before I started doing all those things, and I'd look at them, all those activities, and think about what was my intention in doing those things. Now, on the surface, the intention was to do them. You know, you go to Safeway or whatever, go shopping. Intention is to go buy food for my family and bring it home. What could be simpler, right? Is that the intention is that the only intention that I want to have operating when I go shopping? And if I look at that list and say, no, I don't want to just live my life and kind of being an efficiency expert, getting to the market as quickly as I can and home again. Something as important as going to the market, I'd like to do it in the spirit with the intention that improves life in some way or other. That I go there and I do it in such a way that I'm present and calm or attentive to what's going on, or that I try to be attentive to people around me that I might meet and make a difference in their life, or at least the checkout clerk. My intention is to go and buy groceries and see, can I in some way, that's not too forced or too artificial, can I in some way go down to the checkout counter and have an open heart to this person, be available in a friendly way. And maybe no communication happens, but at least have the intention of being friendly. So I would go through the day in the morning. I sit down on the couch and look at all these things. Okay, shopping, okay. I'm going to do my shopping, of course, but the intention is try to be friendly to the clerk. And, you know, go through the different things and see what the intention I wanted to bring with me to that activity. And because I had this intention in the background, occasionally I remember that. And it kind of shaped my disposition and shaped a little bit not only how I went about doing it, but also enriched the activity. It made it into something much more valuable than simply going to the market and buying something, which is kind of a not very important thing to base your life on. In looking at your deepest intention for your life, one of the traps some people have, especially around careers, is the idea that there's a right career for you, that you just find the right thing to do, you know, your vocation, your calling. And some people find that, and so then you feel like, it should happen to me too. And there are some people for whom they seem to never have a calling. There's never a job which is the job. But rather, how they do their work is their calling. Not what they do, but how they do it. So how they go about whatever job they happen to have is much more important than what they do. And their whole inner life, the inner landscape, the changing transformation, the spiritual transformation that's possible, comes from focusing on how we are, much more on what we're doing. Anything else before we sit? Any last thing that should be? Please.
On my way here today, I was hot and irritable, and I, instead of sitting, decided to go swim. And I started to notice how similar swimming my laps was to walking meditation or sitting. Is there any way you can turn this into a legitimate practice? But I noticed even just keeping with your breath, and it's often a time in which I think, my mind is open.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about this?
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't quite the same as being in the same room with all of you.
The So.
Or some people may be runners.
Yeah, runners, or all there's all kinds of things people can do to clear themselves out and be present. And I remember seeing a movie many years ago, a little documentary, and there was this guy who said, when I was younger, I used to, I think, race motorcycles. And it was really great to race motorcycles because it just cleared me out. And I'd get stressed during the work week, and I'd go race motorcycle on the weekend, and I'd be really clear and present and calm and just emptied my mind really quickly, you know. But then I had kids, and I didn't really have the time and the ability or really desire to do a kind of risky thing anymore. So I stopped, but then I didn't have any means of kind of releasing all the pent-up pressure inside of me. But I had to find something that was quick. So he figured out that getting up early in the morning, just before dawn, and when it was still dark, climbing up big skyscrapers, office buildings that were being built, and kind of sneak in, kind of construction sites, and climb up to the top, with these little parachutes that they could have, and then jump. And then you jump down to the city streets below and have a getaway car nearby. And then they, you know, drive home. And he said, it was really quick. I just jump, and by the time I got to the bottom, I was clear and empty. I'm not sure how to answer your question, your concern. A lot of different activities, like swimming, are conducive to being very mindful, letting go of all the preoccupations, and learning to be really present and open. And anybody who does mindfulness practice, I'd encourage them to bring that practice of presence and mindfulness to whatever you're doing. So if you're swimming, to bring it there. If you're running, if you're working, whatever. Do it in all kinds of circumstances. I think there are advantages of sitting that are absent in something like swimming. One of them is that swimming can be like you're doing something. It can be interesting. You feel like you're accomplishing something. It's kind of engaged in a physical way in what you're doing. So that you're not really leaving yourself alone as uncompromisingly as you're sitting. And when you sit, you leave yourself alone completely uncompromisingly, and you do something that, at least from some people's point of view, is completely pointless and senseless. You know, you're not doing anything. You're not accomplishing anything. You're not even exercising. You're not building up your muscles or anything. You're just sitting there and getting sore knees. And, you know, what good is this? It's a place where you kind of leave yourself alone quite thoroughly and radically. And you're not doing any activity that in and of itself is as conditioning or changing or your state. Whereas swimming, it's kind of easy to change your state. But rather what we're trying to focus on mindfulness is not to change your state, but to be really cognizant, really aware of where you're actually at. In the process of doing that, you might get calm and open, but you want to do it in such a way that you really learn who you are and what makes you operate and what the motivations are and what where your hang-ups are, what your preoccupations are. You want to bring mindfulness and see that. Whereas if you go swimming, you might actually clear the air quite quickly. But you don't really necessarily see, you know, the greed or the fear and how it operates. In mindfulness, the idea is to really see those really clearly. And by seeing those things clearly, become free. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I found it easy to stay with the breath, but you're more concerned about making sure you're getting enough air rather than... I mean, you know, the breath is then used in a different... It's not quite exactly the same as that, because you're paying attention to each breath, but in the same sense, your body's using it in a different way. I mean, as you talked about being a stick in a water, in a stream, where you watch your thoughts or your... go by, there is this preoccupation.
So, for the deeper states of meditation, it's very important to do very little, less and less. So, I mean, the deeper states of meditation aren't accessible, I think, swimming, because there's an activity of the mind that has to be functioning that you can let go of when you're sitting. I had a thought, but the thought. has self-liberated itself. So let us take a couple of minutes to sit quietly.